the Second World War. It was not the war to end all wars, but it was the war that would forever change our world. Take the time to increase your knowledge of this important conflict with the Second World War podcast. All you need to do is search for Second World War with Stephen Bedard on your favorite podcast provider, or go to the website stephenjbedard.com/ww2. Make sure to subscribe today.
In late August 217 BC, 12 exceptionally athletic adolescent boys, known as the Salii, the youngest of the priests to the war god Mars, adorned in the likeness of archaic Roman warriors, wearing short red cloaks, gleaming bronze breastplates and helmets, bronze shields and swords in hand, marched their way through Rome's streets. Flanked by the surrounding slightly older of their college, including the 20-year-old Scipio, who led the youths in hymns and chants, in worship to the divine warrior. Doing this while holding aloft the legionary military trumpets, used for signaling the troops when in battle. Carrying the trumpets to be blessed and purified at the Temple of Mars, to the south of the city, just beyond the first marker, outside the sacred boundary of Rome. The destination to which the Salii were following, singing and chanting in step, adding to the sound by rhythmically hitting their swords against the edge of their shields. Other times, at Scipio's command, the boys suddenly breaking out into moments of strenuous exertion, sweat pouring from their bodies as they began jumping and leaping, executing impressive physical displays of strength and athleticism, all intended to implore the war god for aid, the protection of Rome, and the success of its armies. A long-standing tradition, since the late 700s BC, always conducted in March, linked to the opening of the campaigning season. However, this instance in August 217, an unprecedented event. Because, although it had indeed been done earlier in the year, like for the past 500 years, the augurs had deemed this insufficient for winning the favor of Mars. These being no ordinary times for the Republic, with Hannibal and his Carthaginian army now laying waste to central Italy, after having eviscerated the Romans in three battles and other skirmishes, their losses mounting at a frightening pace, estimated at 61,000 casualties in less than a year, and the augurs now calling for much more elaborate ceremonies to be undertaken, amped up on an incredible scale, not just to Mars, but all the gods of the Roman pantheon, including new statues and structures promised to the major deities, the help of a foreign goddess solicited, a Carthaginian goddess, vowed a temple on the Capitoline Hill if she changed sides, and sacrificial animals offered up by the hundreds, if not the thousands, evidenced by the size of the offering seen by Scipio, as he, the Salii, and his fellow priests reverently approached the Temple of Mars, gently placing the legionary trumpets inside its inner sanctum, while outside, the high priest and the eldest of their order began making the devotions to Mars, in place of the traditional one lamb, scores offered up en masse to the war god. Tremendous religious efforts at a great cost to the state and its people, urgently and fervently being executed by the Republic. Unwilling, perhaps unable to comprehend, that their fundamental problem lay not with the gods, but with their approach to the Second Punic War as a whole, spearheaded by a series of impetuous military commanders that understood little in the way of war beyond charging headlong into battle against an adversary of genius proportions. A recipe, largely responsible for the disasters that had since occurred, and those still to happen, on an unimaginable scale, that would altogether threaten the Republic's very existence. Welcome to the Warlords of History podcast. I'm your host, Mark Pimenta. And to part four of the series on Scipio Africanus. With Hannibal and his now 60,000 strong Carthaginian army, after having won almost total control over the Po Valley in northern Italy, gearing up to resume their invasion in the spring of 217 BC. Underscored by the point that, while Rome had historically faced and overcome numerous trials by fire, never one quite so horrifying as what Hannibal had brought to their doorstep. And as we'll learn about in this episode, while Scipio was back in Rome, after his sobering introduction to war and the dismal results in the north, left witnessing the religious fallout and growing distress over what was appearing to be an invincible foe. How Hannibal enhanced this aura, forcing his way into central Italy through a route believed by the Romans impossible to traverse. Such an incredibly difficult march that it indeed took a heavy toll on his army, personally costing him the sight in one of his eyes. But as intended, allowed him to gain entrance into central Italy undetected, emerging right under the nose of the nearby Roman army under Gaius Flaminius Nepos, another of the Republic's rashly impulsive commanders, that Hannibal, understanding of Flaminius's character and personality, was purposely aiming for. Subsequently, drawing him and his entire body of 25,000 troops into one of the greatest ambushes of antiquity, that in just 3 hours would see over 90% of this force wiped out at the Battle of Lake Trasimene on June 21st, 217 BC, leaving Hannibal and his army standing unchallenged, only 150 kilometers away from Rome, driving the city into a veritable state of panic, and the Senate going to the rare extent of appointing a military dictator to fend off the expected siege of their city. At the same time, with their plight worsening day upon day, also exploding into a religious frenzy, a campaign of a different sorts, making elaborate overtures to the gods to regain their much-needed favor. And although, for reasons that we'll explore, surprisingly, Hannibal didn't take this opportunity to attack their city, instead, moving his army deeper south into the Italian peninsula, what would follow was the Roman dictator Quintus Fabius Maximus, with 40,000 Roman soldiers under his command, undertaking a strategy of attrition through the latter half of 217. That while working, kind of. Not perfectly, but certainly faring much better than the Republic's attempts in the months prior, would nonetheless be pushed aside in early 216, in favor of a return to the Republic's traditional, frontal approach to warfare, upsized, in the biggest Roman mobilization ever conceived up until that point in time, and the largest singular army ever fielded, of 86,000 troops, aiming to deliver a knockout blow to Hannibal, that the 20-year-old Scipio would become involved in as the youngest military tribune within the legions. Under the co-command of the consuls for 216 BC, Scipio's new father-in-law, Lucius Aemilius Paulus, and Gaius Terentius Varro, bringing us right to the eve of the Battle of Cannae, the eve of Rome's greatest military disaster, brought about by the hot-headed Varro, that would become the apex of Hannibal's glittering campaign thus far, leaving Rome teetering on the edge of ruin. All the events, speaking to an underlying but prevalent theme throughout the episode to keep in mind, argued by many a historian, encapsulated by the idea that it wasn't so much that Hannibal figured out a way to win the battles, rather, an absence of talented military leadership among the Romans that was the main culprit behind the overwhelming Carthaginian successes in the early stages of the Second Punic War. An idea that has some merit, but I don't fully agree with. Being that, simply, it's hard to deny Hannibal's military genius, the rare exception, a once-in-a-generation general of outstanding caliber, that I think it's more than fair to say no one would have had a ready answer for. since Hannibal's Roman counterpart, Scipio, the future Scipio Africanus, was still a project in the making. And while the Res Publica did possess many rather skilled and capable commanders, that perhaps against other adversaries would have fared far better. Here's where I see some grains of truth in that idea. Because at the same time, Roman military leadership, reflective of its culture, their traditional approach to warfare and political system, also produced just as many other generals, driven by selfish, short-term personal gains, in view of capturing glory and solidifying their future political careers, that were often not the best people for the job, possessing little in the way of sound military leadership experience, strategy, and tactical skill. Their only recourse, reverting to the long-standing Roman practice of confronting whatever stood in their way straight on, unable to adapt their approach, marching their troops headlong into battle, at the cost of a tremendous loss of life. And certainly not an exaggeration in the context of the Second Punic War, to the near demise of their republic. However, before we march headlong into this episode, it's time for some important shoutouts. Since I have the great pleasure of welcoming Carlton Derrick as an honorary member, and Lars Lund as the newest, full-fledged addition into the ranks of the Warlords of History Immortals. Thank you for supporting my efforts here, with a wider thanks also going out to all the existing Immortals for your ongoing support through the Warlords of History Patreon page and through PayPal, the links for which can be found on the support section of the Warlords of History website. All right, let's get to it. And quick reminder that this episode marks part 4 of the series on Scipio Africanus. So, before having a listen of this installment, if you haven't had a chance to yet, you may want to start with parts 1 through 3 to get all the necessary context as to what we'll be covering off herein. But regardless, here's a quick synopsis of what we covered in the last episode to help put everything into perspective. Starting in December 218 BC, in northern Italy, the Po Valley of Cisalpine Gaul, with the 19-year-old Scipio and his father, Scipio Sr., seeing Roman authority in the region beginning to crumble under the weight of Hannibal and his Carthaginian army. Temporarily stalled by the arrival of Scipio Sr.'s co-consul, Tiberius Sempronius Longus, at the head of 40,000 Roman troops, headlined by its famed heavy infantry that formed the backbone of the legions, the configuration of which we examined in detail, and that, historically, had enabled the Republic's armies to steamroll its way to dominance in Italy. Yet, how greatly this differed from the varied mix of units making up the Carthaginian army, under its genius commander, Hannibal, who, also armed with a deep understanding of Roman battle tactics and his phenomenal intelligence network, in particular, paying keen attention to the personalities and motivations of opposing generals, these insights altogether enabled him to draw Sempronius into a battle fought under terribly unfavorable conditions at the Battle of the Trebia in late December 218 BC. Using this, alongside brilliant ploys and tactics, to win the first full-on pitched battle of the Second Punic War, in convincing style. Better said, as a disaster for Rome, with up to 20,000 of their troops slain and 8,000 taken prisoner. Shortly afterwards, with the Roman Senate promptly calling for Sempronius, Scipio Sr. and his son, R. Scipio, to abandon the region, bringing 10,000 soldiers to reinforce the colony of Ariminum. And although the colonies of Placentia and Cremona remained in Roman hands, nonetheless, leaving Hannibal in full control of the central Po Valley. Moreover, with the Gallic tribes inhabiting the region now enthusiastically flocking over to his side over the winter into the spring of 217 BC, bolstering the count of the Carthaginian army to over 60,000, the timing of which coincided with Scipio's return to Rome in around late February 217 BC. Arriving to see his city at a furious pace, assembling new armies to block Hannibal's entrance into central Italy. Efforts tinged by an oppressive sense of pessimism, in part attributed to the setbacks at Ticinus and the Trebia, but also heavily influenced by their religious beliefs, a sharp increase of disturbing omens and signs being reported on from across the Italian peninsula, interpreted as the Republic somehow having displeased and lost the favor of the gods. With the newly married Scipio then witnessing the people of Rome cascade into a full-fledged panic upon learning the horrific news that not only had Hannibal managed to lead his army into central Italy, but they had also utterly eviscerated a 25,000-strong Roman army at the Battle of Lake Trasimene on June 21, 217 BC, leaving Hannibal and 53,000 Carthaginian troops positioned a mere 150 kilometers away from Rome, with nothing standing in the way of their path to the city. Bringing us to where we left everything off in part 3, in late June 217, with the people of the Res Publica fully expecting Hannibal and his Carthaginian army to come into view and set siege to their city at any moment. An overwhelming sense of fear, heightened by the somber scenes that we touched on towards the closing of the last episode, as the few Roman survivors from the Battle of Lake Trasimene began straggling back to Rome, describing the horrors of what they escaped. Although calling what went down at Lake Trasimene a battle might not at all be fitting, perhaps more accurately described as an unforgiving slaughter, one carefully orchestrated and skillfully executed by Hannibal, enabling him to deliver what the military historian Basil Little Hart, in his book Strategy: The Indirect Approach, called the greatest ambush in history. But hold on a second, how did Hannibal manage to bring all of that to fruition? Let's go slightly back in the chronology to find out. Now, when we last left the Carthaginian commander, it was the spring of 217 BC, having spent the winter encamped within the territory of the Boii Gauls, the area of the modern Italian city Bologna. While readying his army to continue their invasion deeper into the lands of the Roman Republic, receiving envoys from the wider swath of Gallic tribes inhabiting the Po Valley, promising their allegiance and support. As a result, the Carthaginian army dramatically growing in size, nearly doubling from the 33,000 veterans of the recently fought Battle of the Trebia to an estimated count of just over 60,000, greatly strengthened by Gallic muscle. So much, in fact, that Gallic warriors now accounted for more than half of Hannibal's total forces. Some cavalry, but with the vast majority being infantry. That, generally speaking, was no match for the Romans in pitched battle, lacking in formation discipline. However, as mentioned by the ancient Greek historian Polybius, that were known by the Romans for terrifying shock charges, delivered by naked warriors, holding nothing more than shields and broadswords, screaming war cries as they ran into battle, without any semblance of fear. Extremely proficient in unconventional warfare, like raids and guerrilla tactics, placing a huge emphasis on individual bravery and fighting prowess. And now, alongside Hannibal, who were also eagerly looking to depart, venturing deeper into the Republic's domains, as soon as the spring thaw came to the Apennine Mountains of north-central Italy. But for different reasons, the Gauls hungry for plunder, whereas Hannibal, keen to keep up the momentum of his spectacular start to the war. At the same time, wary of eroding the goodwill he had gained by appearing as an occupying force to the Gauls, showing the Carthaginians as different to the domineering Romans that had encroached on and set up colonies on Gallic lands. Speaking of which, despite having lost control over the Po Valley, noteworthy to point out that the Roman presence in the region hadn't been wiped off the map completely, being that the colonies of Placentia and Cremona remained unconquered. So why didn't Hannibal attack or besiege these colonies? Well, although sources disagree on the scale, it seems that after Sempronius, Scipio Sr. and Scipio departed 250 kilometers southeast, taking 10,000 Roman troops along to reinforce the colony of Ariminum on the Adriatic coast, some small preliminary attempts were made by the Carthaginians on the Roman settlements. For example, the ancient Roman historian Livy, referring to a night attack on Placentia that was foiled, thanks to its stout walls and Scipio Sr.'s defensive enhancements, increasing the size of the garrisons as well. Hannibal quickly came to realize that storming the colonies outright would be too costly to his forces. Plus, all sources, ancient and modern, agree on the following reasoning: that sieges took way too long, and the Carthaginian general didn't want to get bogged down, losing the momentum his invasion had built thus far, acting as a key element of his campaign strategy, the cornerstone of which was looking for every opportunity to do what he did best, dominating and shattering the image of Roman power on the battlefield, as a means to galvanize the support of his newfound allies, the Gauls, and in the pursuit of gaining new ones, hoping to steal away the Republic's many Italian allies. Accordingly, when Hannibal departed from his winter quarters around late April, early May 217 BC, he very likely left it to the Gauls, tasking them with keeping the aforementioned colonies contained, continually harassed, to finish off the job there while he led his forces into central Italy, to the lands previously known as Etruria, between the Arno River in the north and the Tiber in the south, corresponding with what are now the regions of Tuscany, northern Lazio, and northwest Umbria, inhabited by the Etruscan civilization, a long-time and formidable adversary of Rome. During its tenure as a kingdom, with Etruscan kings even ruling over Rome for a time, until ousted in 509 BC, giving birth to the Republic. From there, with the two nations vying for supremacy through intermittent wars over the next 250 years, and the legions of Rome, not without setbacks, but steadily capturing more and more of the region until the final conquest of northernmost Etruria, traditionally dated to 264 BC. As always, affirmed through alliances and the establishment of Roman colonies, but important to keep in mind that the majority of these agreements would have been in place for around 1 to 2 centuries by the time of Hannibal's arrival in 217 BC. With an enormous army of 60,000 soldiers under his command, riding at the head of the column on the back of a lumbering war elephant, one with a broken tusk, by the name of Surus, meaning the Syrian. The lone surviving elephant of the 37 that he had brought all the way from Spain and through the Alps, since all the others had died during the Battle of the Trebia and fallen ill over the course of the winter. A problem, yes, since, as proven at the Trebia, elephants could be extremely useful in battle, but a relatively minor issue compared to the much bigger problem at hand, which was how to gain entrance into central Italy. Being that, as pointed out by Patrick Hunt in his book Hannibal, Hannibal knew from his spies and scouts that the Romans had mustered fresh legions under the new consuls, placed at strategic choke points to corral him in, and if he dared to come their way, make the Carthaginians pay dearly for their passage. Two armies, each at a strength of 25,000 troops, one under Gnaeus Servilius Geminus, positioned at Ariminum, modern Rimini, blocking the Via Flaminia, the road connecting Ariminum to Rome. That, interestingly, had been constructed 3 years prior by Servilius's co-consul for 217, Gaius Flaminius Nepos, who, with his 25,000 soldiers, had taken up their post at Arretium, Today, the city of Arezzo, located in the middle of the peninsula, about 200 kilometers to the north of Rome, guarding a well-known pass through the Apennines that exits just to the northeast of Arretium. The only two routes thought passable for such a large invasion force, being that, due to the spring thaw, the area northwest of Arretium, coinciding with the starting point of the Arno River and the Arno River Valley, at that time was a swampy mess of expansive marshes, deepened and worsened by the seasonal spring runoff, which, given his penchant for daring and surprising marches, is exactly why the wily Carthaginian general chose this route. Since, as emphasized by Barry Strauss in his book, Masters of Command, the Romans didn't expect anyone to risk crossing, much less be able to make it through the marshes of the Arno. And although much less famous than his route through the Alps into northern Italy, in my mind, an incredible achievement, considering the terrifying dangers they would soon be confronted with. Hannibal and his large army, thus doing the unexpected and disappearing from view, heading southwards from their winter quarters around the city of Bologna, directly into the Apennine Mountains, undoubtedly aided by Gallic guides. And although their exact route remains unknown to this day, most historical accounts suggest that they emerged from the mountains somewhere around modern Florence, roughly 100 kilometers to the northwest of Arretium, leading to the last leg of their trek into central Italy, by far the most punishing part of their journey. 4 brutally long days of wading and struggling through, at times waist deep, the unending soupy slog, with no dry ground to stop and set up camp, so sleepless as well, subject to a waking nightmare, forced to trudge ever forward through the mud and mosquitoes. In fact, with things getting so bad, in addition to exhaustion and illness, claiming the lives of the majority of their pack animals and supplies, born from the environment were bacterial diseases like cholera that can be fatal within hours, wreaking havoc on his army, claiming an estimated 4,000 to 5,000 troops that either died or deserted along the way. Hannibal too, despite mounted high up on the lone Carthaginian elephant, not escaping unaffected, believed to have contracted something called ophthalmia, the inflammation of the eye, brought on probably by a bacterial or viral infection from the damp and disease-ridden terrain that resulted in him losing sight in one of his eyes. Though, as time would tell, did nothing to slow him down, nor in the slightest damper his military brilliance. Before, sometime in early June, finally exiting the marshes, now with about 55,000 troops in tow. Most importantly, undetected from Roman eyes, resting his exhausted army for several days before starting to pillage the rich Etrurian countryside, replacing their lost pack animals and food stores, taking great pains to keep his main army hidden as they regathered their strength. Beyond gaining the element of surprise, also understanding that something else had drawn Hannibal this way. More specifically, someone, the Roman consul Flaminius, positioned at nearby Arretium with his force of 25,000, who, as David Potter puts it in his book, Origins of Empire, was a Hannibalic dream come true. Impulsive and aggressive, despite possessing limited military experience commanding armies in the field. Also whom, the gods were apparently none too impressed with either, given the foreboding omen associated with the botched sacrifice of a calf when taking his oath of office that we touched on in the last episode, in which we also learned about Hannibal's phenomenal intelligence network, wide-ranging scouting efforts, and his spies in Rome, consistently feeding the Carthaginian general valuable insights as to the position and number of the legions in field, in addition to the personalities of their commanding officers. With two things becoming immediately clear to us at this point. One, that, Like he had done with Sempronius at the Battle of the Trebia, Hannibal planned to provoke the hot-headed Flaminius into battle. And two, Carthaginian scouts had already found the ideal spot in which to do so, along the northern shores of Lake Trasimene, about 40 kilometers due south of Arethium, a spot that the ancient Roman historian Livy described as if designed by nature for ambush, between the adjoining forested hills that slope sharply downwards to the northern edge of the lake, leaving nothing but a very narrow track that widens into a little plain. Where in mid-June, out from hiding, the Carthaginian army began marching towards. Flaminius, undoubtedly taken by surprise to learn that Hannibal had suddenly popped up on the map, so close to and bearing down on his position, anticipating an attack, only to see the Carthaginians simply pass on by Arethium, continuing southwards, making it seem as though they were heading straight to Rome. A feint that, as intended, triggered the rashly impulsive Flaminius, not bothering to wait for any reinforcements from his co-consul situated at Ariminum, about a week's distance away, to immediately order his 25,000 troops out in pursuit, trailing the Carthaginians by less than a day's march, even after learning that Hannibal had suddenly veered eastwards, entering the aforementioned narrow path between the steep hills and the northern shores of Lake Trasimene. The place that would give this battle its name, the Battle of Lake Trasimene, fought on June 21st, 217 BC. The night before the engagement, Flaminius from the Roman camp, blocking the entry point of the path where the Carthaginians had just passed through, across the body of water, seeing their campfires off in the distance, noting their position along the far northeastern part of the shoreline, where Hannibal's Spanish and African heavy infantry would indeed make their stand. An important element of the Carthaginian ploy, and far more campfires than would have been required for the troops sitting around them. Since that night, under the cover of the darkness, Hannibal had ordered almost half of his 55,000 troops to silently take up ambush positions in the forested hills, situated above and across the entire length of the shoreline path, about 4 to 5 kilometers in length. Light troops, like his Balearic slingers and javelin men, and loads of Gallic infantry, particularly suited to this type of guerrilla combat, forming a continuous yet hidden line up to the small plain where Hannibal had positioned his heavy infantry. And lastly, with his Numidian light cavalry that would be used to seal the trap near the opening where the Roman troops would initially need to pass through. That in the early morning of June 21st were commanded by Flaminius to advance into the narrow defile, the Roman commander that Polybius mentioned, utterly regardless of the time or place, was bent only falling in with the enemy, as if victory were a dead certainty. Keeping in mind, however, that Flaminius made a spectacular blunder in not sending in scouts beforehand to investigate what awaited them and better ascertain the deployment of the Carthaginian forces. That obscured from view, and certainly not helped by the dense morning fog that formed over the landscape, which, due to the geography, particularly in the summer months, apparently remains a common occurrence to this day, drove Flaminius, heedless to the dangers, to plunge his army headlong into the trap that awaited them. And just as the Roman vanguard came into view of Hannibal's Spanish and African infantrymen, ready to battle it out in the small plain, Carthaginian horns began blaring out, reverberating across the landscape, signaling the Numidians to descend from the hills and block the entrance, closing off any chance of a Roman escape, while Hannibal's heavy infantry connected with the Roman vanguard on the other end, followed by the other Carthaginian ambush groups emerging out from their hiding spots and the thick fog to begin attacking the Roman column across the entire length of their line. that was penned in along the shoreline pathway, without enough space nor the time to allow the doomed legions to form into any semblance of a coherent battle formation and offer up an organized defense. A grisly scene, best described by Polybius when he says, "The sudden appearance of the enemy took Flaminius completely by surprise, and as the condition of the atmosphere rendered it very difficult to see, and their foes were charging down on them in so many places from higher ground, the Roman centurions and the tribunes were not only unable to take any effectual measures to set things right, but could not even understand what was happening. No matter which way the Romans turned, death came from everywhere." In this 3-hour encounter, much more accurately described as a Roman slaughter, rather than that of a battle. And although similar to what had happened at the Battle of the Trebia, a group of 6,000 Roman infantry at the front managed to break through Hannibal's heavy infantry, escaping the trap, they were later chased down and taken prisoner. And while Flaminius, despite having the opportunity to try and escape with those 6,000 troops, to his credit, chose to stay behind, trying to salvage this wreckage of a situation, but was soon overwhelmed, cut down, by a Gallic commander by the name of Ducarius. Flaminius's death, accounting for just one of the estimated 15,000 Romans that fell that day, and around 8,000 that were taken prisoner, over 90% of the 25,000 strong Roman army gone in an instant. A comprehensive victory for Hannibal that came at the cost of a mere 2,000 casualties for the Carthaginian forces. Clearly, a disaster for the Romans, which, as you may recall from the closing of the last episode, certainly heightened the impending sense of doom felt amongst the populace in Rome, in part attributed to Hannibal's earlier victories at Ticinus and the Trebia, layered upon deep religious concerns, the ominous dark omens being sent by the gods. However, now, raised to an entirely new level by the terrified accounts of the 1,500 or so Roman soldiers that managed to scramble their way back to Rome in the days that followed the Battle of Lake Trasimene, met by frantic crowds at the gates, describing to them the grisly aftermath, the merciless butchery of thousands of Roman soldiers lying slain along the path and the shallows of the northern shoreline. That, of course, Scipio in Rome would have learned of as well. Made worse days later by more distressing news from the field, an additional 4,000 Roman cavalry sent by Servilius to help bolster Flaminius's forces that, unaware of what had happened while en route, were too ambushed by the Carthaginians, half of which were killed and the other half taken prisoner, leaving the people of Rome in a dreadful state, their confidence shattered, now anticipating Hannibal's imminent arrival at their gates, bringing his 53,000 troops to set siege to Rome. And in truth, never before had the Res Publica encountered such an adversary, even during the Pyrrhic War in the 270s BC against another brilliant commander of the ancient world, King Pyrrhus, who had won his first two pitched battles against Rome in a convincing style. But even there, in those encounters, the Roman losses had never been so heavy, nor as one-sided as experienced during the early stages of Hannibal's campaign. The scale of the Roman setbacks at this stage, staggering to consider. The lives of 61,000 soldiers lost in 8 months, versus Carthaginian battlefield casualties of only around 8,000. Though, as we'll find out in the next episode, with much darker days still laying ahead. Nonetheless, with Rome in a state of crisis, given its vulnerability and all the measures they had taken so far, readily crushed by Hannibal, the Roman Senate finally coming to the realization that a change in strategy was urgently needed. After shutting themselves into the Curia Hostilia, the Senate House, for emergency deliberations, 2 days later, emerging with a new plan in hand, having gone to the desperate extent of appointing a dictator to take charge of the war effort against Hannibal. Under a grizzled, elderly veteran by the name of Quintus Fabius Maximus. A rare enough occurrence, since the people of the Roman Republic were exceedingly wary of anything resembling a king. The term dictator, possibly conjuring up for you images of historical leaders with unassailable influence held for years over the length of their reigns. Which is partially true in this case, since dictators were indeed handed near-absolute powers to deal with whatever emergency at hand. However, important to note that in the Roman Republic, leery of placing too much power in any one hand for extended periods of time, these individuals were only permitted to do so under strict timelines. For Fabius, a 6-month period that would end by late December 217 BC. Furthermore, balancing out his unfettered power by appointing a second in command, the Magister Equitum, meaning Master of the Horse, Marcus Minucius Rufus, in sole control of the Roman cavalry forces. Two men that couldn't be more different in terms of personality and character. Minucius, temperamental and overtly aggressive, standing in contrast to Fabius, who was immovably cautious, methodical, and steadfast, possessing amazing attention to detail. And now, saddled with the responsibility of preventing the whole-scale collapse of Rome, promptly set to work. In anticipation of the upcoming siege, as mentioned by Robert Garland in his book, Hannibal, even though Rome was already well protected by its formidable Servian walls, Fabius added to this by repairing and enhancing any potential weak points in its fortifications and breaking down the bridges over the Tiber River, while conducting an emergency levy to raise a new army, of course including sending out riders to Rome's nearest allies demanding the same. That, in the coming weeks, a phenomenally short time frame, would see Rome produce another 40,000 strong army. In addition to all the military preparations underway, there was also the business of the disgruntled gods to attend to, trying to figure out which ones needed to be appeased. Accordingly, Roman efforts to regain the favor of the gods, greatly intensifying at this point, believed vital to turn the tide of the Second Punic War. And considering the gravity of what had happened thus far, in combination with their deep religious beliefs as covered in the last episode, I think it's easy for us to understand how the Romans came to the conclusion that the gods were no longer on their side. Being that their traditional approach to warfare had worked for eons, surely something else was at play preventing it from working now. However, because it was unclear as to which deities in particular were disgruntled, the help of all the major gods was solicited, with much of the responsibility for this falling upon the patricians, particularly those who filled the priestly colleges of Rome, that Livy tells us included things like sacrificing animals en masse, such as 300 oxen that were offered up to Jupiter Optimus Maximus, dedicating new structures and more ornate statues to the gods, organizing something called a lectisternium, essentially an elaborate banquet, including all manner of sumptuous food and drink, solely for the enjoyment of the major deities in which to feast, along with the ceremonies that Scipio himself would have been involved in as a priest of the Roman war god Mars, that we covered at the top end of the episode. In the likeness of those that typically mark the opening of the military campaigning season, though amped up on an incredible scale. And lastly, just in case the Roman gods weren't enough, even going to the extent of seeking foreign divine aid, Venus Erycina, who, interestingly, was originally a Carthaginian goddess that the Romans were now trying to win over by vowing a temple to her on the Capitoline Hill. And according to Robert Garland, would in fact become the first foreign deity to be worshipped inside the sacred boundary surrounding the city of Rome. All these tremendous efforts, both religious and military, unfolding in the days and weeks following the Battle of Lake Trasimene, in order to help protect Rome from Hannibal. Speaking of which, where was he? Surely he should have reached Rome by now. But the thing is, despite the Roman fears and expectations, a Carthaginian siege or assault on their city never materialized, with Hannibal instead choosing to lead his army away from Rome. For the next 2 months, from Lake Trasimene, marching eastwards through Umbria to the Adriatic coast, and then south, down along the coastline, to somewhere around the modern city of Foggia, in the region of Apulia, the region that makes for the upper heel of Italy's boot, with his army pillaging and plundering the countryside as they traveled. Which raises the question, why didn't Hannibal attack or lay siege to Rome after the Battle of Lake Trasimene, squandering what some historians call his golden opportunity to attack the heart of the Roman Republic? It was a decision forced by two fundamental challenges facing the Carthaginian general: access to troop reinforcements and food, challenges that worsened the deeper they marched into hostile territory. In that, while it was indeed true that they were only 150 kilometers away, with no Roman army standing in the way of his path to Rome at this point, the city still held a garrison of an estimated 10,000 troops. In the field, a force that wouldn't have been much of a problem for Hannibal and his 53,000-strong army to handle. However, fighting from Rome's imposing walls and fortifications, Hannibal would have been acutely aware that they were more than numerous enough to capably defend the city, making any attempts by the Carthaginians to storm Rome potentially ruinous to his army, especially since Hannibal didn't have any ready access to troop reinforcements. Okay, but then why not a siege? The decision not to pursue this, largely stemming from logistical issues, not having access to adequate food stores to keep his large army fueled, which was a nagging problem for Hannibal, possessing no reliable supply base, therefore making the prospect of a long-winded siege almost impossible, since they didn't have enough resources to stay in one spot for too long, the only remedy for which was constantly foraging and plundering the landscape. So while we can't know for certain what would have happened if Hannibal had elected to besiege Rome, perhaps it could have been taken by some form of clever trickery. This would have been a long shot, and we can confidently reason that, if attempted, while struggling to scour the countryside for food to keep the siege going, the Carthaginians would have still been vulnerable to external attacks, since Servilius was still stationed at Ariminum with 21,000 troops, and Rome could still add to this strength by raising troops from amongst its allies and colonies. So here we have two significant challenges: ready access to food and troop reinforcements, laddering up to, arguably, one of the fatal flaws with Hannibal's overarching campaign strategy, that is, at least when it came to central Italy. Structured upon demonstrating Roman weakness on the battlefield in order to steal the Res Publica's allies away. Because, despite having won, in a crushing fashion, three successive battles against the Republic so far, unlike what happened in the Po Valley, with the Gallic tribes readily tossing aside their Roman alliances and going over to Hannibal, Andrew Lintott, in his book The Roman Republic, tells us, not one of Rome's central Italian allies had defected or opened the gates of their cities to Hannibal by this point. Certainly, Hannibal was offering freedom from under Roman domination. But what he found, surprisingly, and frustratingly, was that Rome's Etrurian and other central Italian alliances were impressively rock solid. Being that, a bit of an oversimplification, but life for them was simply better under Roman domination. To illustrate this a little better, back in part 1 we covered what the nature of the Roman Republic's system of alliances looked like. Essentially, a great many bilateral agreements imposed upon those they had defeated, allowing for colonies to be set up on their lands, and the provision of soldiers whenever Rome demanded it. Of course, coming at the cost of a loss of sovereignty for the ally in question, such as being prohibited from engaging in foreign affairs, but typically with their internal social, political, and religious institutions left largely intact, allowing them to govern themselves as they saw fit, provided this didn't stand in opposition to the Republic's objectives, but also coinciding with loads of benefits, such as in trade and commercial ties, facilitating huge economic upswings, increased wealth and well-being enjoyed by the people therein, which helped to facilitate, let's say, a broader cultural Romanization of the inhabitants, in turn, a growing sense of unity. In fact, with the majority of Rome's longest-term allies, most of whom were in central Italy, by this point, even having been granted a limited form of Roman citizenship. Not full citizenship, since they didn't have any voting rights in the Republic's political affairs, nor could they hold public office, but did confer important privileges, such as being recognized as a citizen under Roman law, granting them the right to do things like engage in commerce, intermarry with Romans, and acquire property within Roman territory. Beyond this, however, another keystone to the strength of Rome's central Italian alliances was protection. Understanding that, Rome had proven themselves a reliable military ally over time, keeping up their end of the bargain. For example, among the cities in Etruria, in addition to having fought against Rome historically, as mentioned earlier, also having had to deal with regular Gallic raids and incursions emanating from Cisalpine Gaul. But after allying with Rome, hugely benefiting from the protection of their unstoppable legions, since it was in the interest of the Republic to promptly stop these incursions before they threatened Rome's colonies or Rome itself, alluding to what Polybius refers to as a firm sense of loyalty, born of the awe and respect that the allies felt for the Roman state. And what's resoundingly clear within the context of the Second Punic War at this juncture was that Hannibal wasn't doing himself any favors or winning any new friends in central Italy by despoiling their lands like a swarm of locusts. Furthermore, as previously noted, being that over 50% of his army consisted of Celtic warriors, this configuration too did little to endear Hannibal to the central Italian allies that for eons had been fighting against the Gauls and dealing with Gallic raids. And now, armed with all this knowledge, we can much better understand why Hannibal led his army 500 kilometers southeast over the next 2 months, from Lake Trasimene, landing in the region of Apulia in southeastern Italy around August 217 BC. With a great deal of the motivation behind this move, driven by Hannibal's need to gain allies, a more secure area to operate from, perhaps even winning the Carthaginians a supply base, feeling that Rome's southern Italian allies would be easier to peel off. In part, influenced by what had went down at Clistidium back in December 218, as covered in the previous episode, when the southern Italian allied garrison protecting that grain depot in the Po Valley, with hardly any opposition offered, opened the gates to the Carthaginians and joined with Hannibal. An event that highlights for us another important point, that much of the southern peninsula, Magna Graecia, had only been subjugated by Rome in the late 270s BC, some 60 years prior. With Hannibal, like a shark sniffing at blood in the ocean from miles away, pursuing any vulnerability he could exploit. And when combined with his masterful domination of the battlefield, confident in his ability to continue winning battles, thus trampling over the visage of Roman invincibility, trying to show it an illusion. It was through this that he believed the allies of southern Italy, with bonds to Rome much weaker than that of those in central Italy, could be won over. Perhaps even starting a domino effect, reverberating beyond Magna Graecia. And while we can't know for certain what the tone of his communications and envoys were with the cities of southern Italy, although there were indeed some, no one had jumped ship yet, though he must have suspected that he was close to gaining their allegiance. But again, all of this contingent on Hannibal continuing to crush Rome on the battlefield. An understanding also held by the recently appointed Roman dictator, Quintus Fabius Maximus, who marched out from Rome in late August 217 BC at the head of 40,000 troops, making straight for the Carthaginian army running around loose in Apulia. Not to fight a pitched battle, but rather stay close, purposely avoiding any major encounters, while tightly trailing the Carthaginian force, giving birth to what has since been hailed as the Fabian strategy, a strategy of attrition. Fabius, of course, fully aware that the Roman troops under his command were in need of much more training, no match for the veteran Carthaginian army. But even had it been veteran legions he was leading there, I suspect this would have done little to have changed his approach, since he wasn't the type of military leader to take any undue risks. Also because, as emphasized by Barry Strauss, Fabius understood that Hannibal's strength was his army, and its forte was pitched battle, whereas their weakness was the need to replenish supplies and numbers of men, both of which he lacked. Accordingly, Fabius, settling on a course of wearing the Carthaginians down, slowly constricting them. So for the next weeks and months, where the Carthaginian army traveled, Fabius's army followed, like a shadow, always setting up their camps on high ground, easily defensible and inaccessible to enemy cavalry, striking out in guerrilla-type assaults when excellent opportunities arose, only allowing for small-scale skirmishes, attacking Carthaginian foragers, while watching the movements of their main army closely, enabling Fabius to easily discern and anticipate where they were heading, employing a scorched-earth policy as well, having crops burnt to ashes so his Punic foes couldn't make use of them. And lastly, regularly peeling off detachments of his 40,000 troops to reinforce the garrisons of the cities that Hannibal passed by, so that they couldn't be stormed unless at a high casualty cost to the Carthaginians, one that Hannibal couldn't afford. A strategy that was starting to work, putting immense pressure on the dwindling Carthaginian supplies, while severely hampering Hannibal's ability to wage war or achieve anything of significance. And despite repeated attempts by the Carthaginian commander to entice a full-on pitched battle, finding Fabius impossible to provoke. This continuing into the early autumn of 217, as Hannibal led his army 200 kilometers west from Apulia across the width of the peninsula into the rich agricultural region of Campania that surrounds modern Naples on the southwestern Italian coast, where the open landscape was exceptionally suited for Hannibal's cavalry to run rampant, and despite Fabius's best attempts, unable to prevent their plundering of the harvest, gathering a rich haul of livestock and food for the coming winter, before starting to make their way back to Apulia around late October or early November, which caught Hannibal in a trap, since Fabius, wisely, had positioned his army on the heights of the Casilinum Pass, just to the northeast of the city of Capua, where the Carthaginians would need to cross through to return to their winter quarters. A crossing that would have been devastating for anyone to attempt. Though, I should say, almost anyone. Because, as we well know by now, Hannibal was no ordinary military leader, quickly coming up with another of his magnificent ploys. with the Carthaginian army situated just outside the pass, and the Roman army on the heights above, expecting an attack. Hannibal waited until the dead of night before ordering torches tied up to the horns of 2,000 cattle they had plundered and set alight. That, accompanied by light Carthaginian skirmishers trailing behind, were then driven in groups and up in several directions into the forested mountains occupied by the Romans. In the dark, appearing to the Romans as though thousands of enemy troops holding torches were approaching, producing a scenario of mass confusion, best described by Livy when he writes that as the oxen suddenly rushed this way and that, all the bushes far and near seemed to be burning, as if the woods and mountains had been set on fire, causing the bulk of the Romans to gather and ready themselves at the summits of the ridges, also running into light-armed soldiers of the enemy. In the midst of all that chaos, a clever distraction, Hannibal quietly leading his army into the pass, where the few remaining Roman troops, about 1,000, were easily overwhelmed and cut down, allowing the entire Carthaginian force to cross through the Casilinum Pass unscathed, and with all their plunder. A humiliation for Fabius. One that seems to have been the breaking point in Rome for the support of his strategy. An uproar of dissent at the lack of more immediate results. In fact, earning him the unflattering nickname Cunctator, meaning the delayer, with others degrading him as Hannibal's manservant. Impatience and frustration beginning to boil over regarding his prudent approach, that although not working perfectly, but had shown it could be pretty effective, in essence was very un-Roman. As mentioned by Barry Strauss when he points out that Roman culture worshipped the military offensive and looked down on defense. A sentiment also felt by Fabius's second, the master of horse, Minucius, that shortly after the events at Casilinum, when Fabius was temporarily recalled to Rome to participate in some important religious sacrifices. Despite ordered otherwise, Minucius took it upon himself to lead the Roman army into a major skirmish against Hannibal's forces at a place called Gerunium, a minor victory, painted as a major victory, that convinced the Senate to appoint Minucius as co-dictator, on equal standing with Fabius, who then split the 40,000 Roman army between them. But when, shortly after that encounter, Minucius led his contingent against Hannibal again, the Carthaginian commander managed to draw Minucius into an ambush. And just as they were about to be resigned to the same cruel fate that had befallen the Romans at Lake Trasimene, Minucius and his soldiers were saved from destruction by the last-minute arrival of Fabius and his half of the army that ultimately forced a Carthaginian retreat. However, with December 217 drawing to a close, and the dictatorship coming to an end, requiring Fabius and Minucius to return to Rome, was an event that did little to change the fervor building in the city to revert to the offensive, amplified on an unprecedented scale, determined to deliver a knockout blow to Hannibal. Led by the consuls elect, poised to take office in March 216 BC, Gaius Terentius Varro, another fiery, hot-headed leader, interestingly, the son of a butcher, who despite his low plebeian birth had impressively risen through the Republic's political ranks, and Scipio's new father-in-law, Lucius Aemilius Paulus, with a distinguished military career under his belt, evidenced by his celebration of a triumph for leading an extremely successful campaign in Illyria 3 years prior, both under whom the largest Roman army ever would soon be assembled, with one of the first orders of business for the incoming consuls, prior to this monumental levy of the legions, was the appointment of the military tribunes that were to serve under them. Younger, typically aristocratic Roman citizens, acting in the capacity of junior military officers, responsible for managing and overseeing the rank and file, also relaying the orders of the consul and his surrounding high command to the regular troops, 6 of which were assigned to each legion. And although Polybius mentions that the minimum requirement was having at least 5 years military experience, it probably comes as no surprise that despite considerably shy of this threshold, given the fame he had since gained, and that his father-in-law was one of the incoming consuls, that the now 20-year-old Scipio was also named as a military tribune. With Livy pointing out that Scipio was in fact the youngest of the tribunes, probably by a considerable distance, since most of them would have been at least in their mid-20s and older, yet all of whom would have been eager and honored to have been selected as a part of this unprecedented Roman force, intending to face the Carthaginian threat and its skilled general head-on, once and for all. However, underscored by a foundational problem with the Republic's approach to Hannibal's invasion as a whole up to this point, centered around its overarching military strategy, but also in terms of on-the-ground battlefield tactics. Or, should I say, lack thereof, coming from a lack of consistent, truly skilled and talented Roman military leadership at the top. Now, to clarify, I'm not saying that they were all bad or incompetent. In fact, far from it, many quite good. However, the Republic also had quite the track record of subpar commanders being put into military leadership positions that they perhaps had no business being in. Two prime examples, including Sempronius and Flaminius, considering their horrific blunders at the battles of the Trebia and Lake Trasimene respectively. Also Minucius, who walked his troops into a trap, saved by Fabius's arrival. And while certainly none could have been said to have been lacking in bravery and motivation, the main problem I'm highlighting here is that Roman generals, for the most part, were almost cookie-cutter in a sense, confronting whatever stood in front of them in the same toe-to-toe fashion, charging headlong into battles through frontal collisions, unable to approach new challenges with dynamic flexibility. Producing an interesting conundrum here, a double-edged sword, in that it's hard to fault them entirely, since theirs was a time-tested approach, reflective of Rome's warrior culture and guiding virtues. The Roman way of waging war, always about facing its enemies head-on. Even the legions were built this way, having worked exceedingly well historically, allowing them to reign supreme on the Italian peninsula. However, this wasn't because Roman generalship had always been exceptional. It was more so attributed to the quality of the legions, led by its heavy infantry, and the deep pool of military manpower available to the Republic. Roman infantry, that despite being thrust into terribly unfavorable situations by their leaders at the Trebia and Trasimene, still performed quite well, both times smashing clean through the opposing Carthaginian infantry lines. Bringing us to the second part of that recipe for success, as we've come across at various times throughout the series so far. Because Roman history up to this point had been beset with heavy military setbacks and battle losses. But, to put it plainly, the Republic simply wouldn't stop sending army after army until they won the last battle of whichever war was being fought. Though, in now being faced with an adversary the likes of Hannibal, this rigid way of thinking and waging war among the high Roman command would nearly trigger the Republic's collapse. And while there were some exceptions to this rule, of course Scipio in the future, Fabius being a good more immediate example, who conceived a novel approach, the Fabian strategy that was starting to work, staving off disaster and keeping the Carthaginians somewhat contained. Instead of optimizing what was showing promise, this strategy was tossed aside, returning to their original approach, but amplified on an epic scale, highlighting an important insight or drawback of the Republic, the other edge of that sword that caused it to regularly churn out lackluster commanders. understanding that consuls were not always elected to this highest of offices, and thus handed positions of military leadership because they were the best quality generals, having earned it based on merit. For many, it was because they were skilled politicians with high social status and wealth. And while the counterargument here might be military service was foundational to the cursus honorum for anyone and all with high-reaching political aspirations in Rome, I would say having experience is one thing, being in a position of ultimate command, something else entirely. Moreover, with said consuls having only 1 year to achieve their intended goals, beyond not having prolonged timeframes to hone their skills as a commander, learning the art of war at a high level, this time constraint contributed to them taking foolhardy risks in the effort to make a lasting impact, winning personal and familial glory, enhancing their dignitas and ongoing relevance in the public eye. As we've learned so far, and with more still to come, often producing disastrous results for the Republic. A sentiment that Edward Watts, in his book, Mortal Republic, How Rome Fell into Tyranny, encapsulates exceptionally well when he writes, "Short-term domestic political competition seldom breeds good military strategy." A sentiment well-fitting of Sempronius at the Battle of the Trebia, Flaminius at Lake Trasimene, and Minucius, the recent master of horse. And that, sadly, appears to also have been applicable when it came to Gaius Terentius Varro, consul for 216 BC, elected alongside Lucius Aemilius Paulus, Scipio's father-in-law. Both of whom, in January 216, began overseeing the biggest mobilization Rome had ever completed, that, over the next months, would form into the largest singular army ever fielded by the Republic, that Paulus and Varro would co-lead, alternating command each day. From Polybius we learn, consisting of 8 Roman legions, an unheard-of figure for one army, since only 2 years prior, a typical consular army would have included only 2 Roman legions. And instead of the normal 4,200 infantry assigned to each, a number that was increased to 5,000 per legion, totaling an estimated 40,000 Roman soldiers and 40,000 from its Italian allies, with roughly an equal split for the 6,000 cavalry as well. In all, amounting to an incredible force of 86,000 troops, 80,000 infantry and 6,000 cavalry. A behemoth mobilization that was extremely difficult to put together, in part due to the immense financial burdens that Rome was struggling under, as expressed by David Potter when he points out that in 216, the resources of the state were stretched to their limits. Because, remember, the Republic was, at the same time, fielding armies in other theaters, including in northeastern Spain under Scipio's father and uncle, another force operating out of Ariminum, dealing with the Gauls of the Po Valley, and a sizable allotment of troops stationed in Sicily, so close to the Punic heartland in North Africa. Somewhere in the realm of 130,000 Roman and allied soldiers that were active on the board in 216. Alluding to another significant issue with the mobilization at hand, in that the length of time required to execute yet another large levy was taking much longer than usual, forcing the Republic to lower the age limit and property requirements for citizen participation in the army, given the manpower that the Romans had been hemorrhaging in such a short amount of time, finding them increasingly difficult to replace. Added to the fact that they had conscripted 40,000 soldiers in early 217, and another 40,000 midway in the same year. Those levied 6 months prior to this point, under Fabius's dictatorship, a grouping that now had some combat experience under their belts, accounting for almost half of the 86,000 strong army being assembled to defeat Hannibal once and for all. However, with the other half, newly levied, raw and untested. a process that Scipio would have had an active hand in organizing in accordance with the duties of a military tribune. That the Osprey book, Rome at War, helps detail for us, with Scipio and his fellow tribunes responsible for conducting the selection to fill the ranks of the legions, wherein all the citizens conscripted for service assembled on the Capitoline Hill, where they were arranged by height and age, then brought forward in groups for selection by the tribunes of each legion, taking turns to have first choice of each grouping brought before them, to ensure that the experienced men and those in the best physical condition were evenly distributed among the legions. Among other duties for the tribunes, that would have also included overseeing the administration of their assigned legion, ensuring the logistical and equipment needs of the soldiers were being met, and that strict discipline was being enforced and maintained among the troops, training as well, to prepare them for battle, an important feature of what had made the legion so formidable historically. However, a serious problem arose here as well, because, as mentioned by Patrick Hunt, so much time was spent in gathering troops in this instance that training time was compromised. By how much, we don't know exactly. However, by all accounts, severely cut short, with the massive army, in particular for the more than half recently levied, being noted as lacking in cohesion and discipline. Yet, with the consuls, nonetheless, leading them out from Rome, around early June 216 BC, beginning the 400-kilometer journey southeast, straight towards Apulia, where the Carthaginian army was based. Also, where Hannibal, through his spies in Rome, understanding the size of the force Rome was amassing, but also their lack of training, wisely took preemptive measures to draw them out, pressuring a Roman response. By aggressively raiding around and threatening to attack the Roman colonies in northern Apulia through the late spring and early summer of 216, before sacking and taking possession of a major Roman food and supply depot at a place called Cannae. Choosing to stay put there with his now 50,000 strong army, selecting it as an ideal battle site, since the surrounding lands, with the Aufidus River running through it, modern Ofanto River, was flat enough to offer an excellent landscape to exploit his advantage in cavalry, but flanked by hills that he knew would constrain the ranks of the tremendous Roman numbers, should they take the bait. Which they did, steadily progressing en route, and irrespective to the training deficit afflicting half its army, with Rome confident that the crushing weight of their vastly superior numbers would enable them to squash the Carthaginian threat. And with Scipio marching along, within the ranks of this tremendous army, the youngest of the 48 military tribunes therein, a force bolstered by patriotic fervor, also laden with volunteers from among the Roman aristocracy, including former consuls from previous years, other magistrates, and nearly 100 men of senatorial rank, wanting to be a part of the biggest force ever assembled, at Rome's greatest hour of need, in anticipation of their greatest victory. That on August 2nd, 216 BC, in the hands of the consul Varro, like his impetuous colleagues before him, would plunge the 86,000 Roman troops under his command into battle, instead yielding Rome's darkest hour. In the next episode, we'll continue from here, going deep into the Battle of Cannae, a day of unspeakable carnage and gravity for the Republic, wherein the visage of Roman power would be shattered on an unimaginable scale. With Scipio, in its immediate aftermath, showing signs of a magnificent leader in the making, first leading 10,000 survivors to safety, and then preventing the desertion of the despairing troops. Despairing over the results of the battle, and Rome's image of dominance broken, which began reverberating far beyond Cannae's blood-drenched grounds, dislodging many of Rome's southern Italian allies to Hannibal's side, soon followed by some in central Italy, and then foreign powers that began forming alliances with the Carthaginian commander. With the Republic facing its demise, economic turmoil, and severe constraints in military manpower. Yet, despite Hannibal's overtures to negotiate, finding the Senate unbending, their virtue of gravitas tested to the extreme, defiantly expressed, in that Rome would accept nothing less than total victory, while scrambling to put together yet another army. Returning again to Fabius and his strategy to stave off total disaster as the Second Punic War trudges on, but slows to a crawl in Italy, giving Scipio, back in Rome, the time to leverage his skyrocketing fame to begin climbing Rome's political gauntlet, before, in 210 BC, after his father and uncle are killed, volunteering to pick up the baton where they had left it, given his first command to lead the legions in a renewed assault in Hispania. This and more to come in the next episode of the Warlords of History podcast. And in the meanwhile, if you want to support the podcast, there are many ways you can help. You can tell your family and friends about the show. Please rate, review, and subscribe on whichever platform you happen to access the show on. You can follow the podcast on Twitter, Instagram, or Facebook. And lastly, you can head on over to the show's website, warlordsofhistory.com, where, on the support section of the site, you can find the show's Patreon or PayPal links in the event that you want to contribute to the podcast directly. But beyond this, where I'll include some additional info, like images and maps pertaining to this episode for your viewing pleasure, and where you can also reach out to me with any thoughts, questions, or suggestions. I would love to hear from you. Thanks for listening, and I hope you enjoyed the episode. Theme music from Audionautix.com.